Take me to the city dome. Just when you thought it was safe to be a piece of historic ornamental concrete, we learn from Seattle Center that the old Civic Arena gargoyles, the very same gargoyles famously rescued 2 years ago by the man sitting right over there, have been taken to the city dump. Felix Bunnell is our resident historian, and I heard about this for the first time yesterday.
I did, too. Crosscut posted a story by a writer named Brandon Davis. We're going to hear from Brandon in a moment about what happened, but first, listeners might remember that saga that unfolded almost exactly 2 years ago. The old Mercer Arena at Seattle Center next to KCTS was slated for demolition to make way for the Seattle Opera's new headquarters. Now, the building had been gussied up for the 1962 World's Fair, but at its heart was a 1928 structure once known as the Civic Arena or Civic Ice Arena. Now, I wondered in my story how much of the ornate old 1928 facade was hidden behind the 1960s brick. I reported that all the consultants, all the Seattle Center staff, all the opera staff assured me, oh, there's nothing left behind that. They got rid of that in 1961 when they put that brick wall up. Of course, the very next day, I'm standing there like Geraldo Rivera with my Lake Washington fellow kangaroo, Bill Wixie, and we watch, dumbfounded, as the bricks come down, and there's the 1928 building, as if a ghost or something had crawled out of the grave, completely intact. It was frightening. I remember my knees feeling weak. And right away, the demolition crews, they start tearing it down. Like, we didn't pause a second, including these gargoyles sitting on these four columns in front of the doors. We had our cameras rolling. I had my phone. Bill had a guy from Q13 shooting with a real video camera. Anyway, ultimately, two of those four gargoyles were preserved, and they promised the Seattle Center they'd be used somewhere in the center. They'd be, honor the tradition, the history. But late last month, something went wrong, and this is Seattle Center spokesperson Deborah Doust.
The grotesques were outside the Seattle Opera at the center, the building, the former Mercer Arena. And they were being held there until we determined a place for them to be on the ground. And then one day they were taken away.
Simple as that. They were taken away. So the term grotesque, she used, that's sort of interchangeable with gargoyle. It's a little pedantic, but, gargoyle, grotesque, whatever. Anyway, I asked Deborah, who took their gargoyles away and why?
It was part of our maintenance crew. They were responding to requests to clean up some of the debris that was left over from the center construction.
So they're just following orders, they say. It's not Deborah's fault, but it's still unclear exactly who dropped the ball and let the old gargoyles be taken away to the dump when they were supposed to be saved. Now, I mentioned Brandon Davis. She writes for Crosscut. Her office is in the old KCTS building right there. She told me she used to walk past their gargoyles sitting on a pallet behind the new opera building, and she sort of became attached to them. She'd check in on them every week or so. Like, they were like her little friends there. And unfortunately, last month, she took a business trip.
I was out of town. I was in Boston at a conference the week before, when they actually apparently had been moved. So, of course, I felt horrible that I'd gone to this conference in Boston and missed the moment that I could have thrown my body over the gargoyles.
I like Brandon. I think I would get along well with her. We understand these attachments to these inanimate objects and this sort of and irrational thoughts about them. One question that many people are asking is, which landfill did the gargoyles get taken to, and can we mount a search? I asked Brandon Davis how far she's willing to go to try and find the lost gargoyles.
I am not sure at this point. I mean, I made my calls. I can leave more messages. I have to tell you, I don't feel optimistic about the landfill possibility. But, maybe they're out there. Maybe this article will spawn swarms of citizenry going out to the to the landfill looking for these things. I mean, it's pretty recent that they disappeared.
Oh, it's going to be like an archaeologist 1,000 years from now finds them, wonders how they got there.
Well, there's a couple theories. There's one theory is that maybe they got diverted to someone's backyard and their lawn ornaments.
Ah. Now,
and Deborah Doust, I reached out to her late last night about what landfill they actually went to. Haven't heard back yet. And I'm not ready to give up hope, and I think I'm going to borrow $100 from John Curley, and I'm going to offer a reward. I'm serious. I put a bounty out there for information leading to the recovery of these gargoyles. Heck, I'll even take you to lunch at the food circus and take you for a ride on the monorail. We'll celebrate.
Really?
I'm offering
$100.
Even if Curley won't lend me $100, I'm going to put up $100 for a reward. I think it's worth trying to find these gargoyles, and I think our listeners out there have the power, the drones, the ability to get to reach out to City Hall, figure out where these might have ended up. And
well,
find
for lunch
them.
At the food circus, I'll keep my eyes peeled. Is the Belgian waffle place still there?
I don't think so, but there's other plenty of other good modern 21st century choices.
All right. Felix Bunnell, our resident historian, all his pieces are on display at mynorthwest.com. Let's take you now to Jerusalem and the offices of the Media Line run by Michael Friedson. We've been hearing that the Israeli election is a tie.
It's a tie, except that one of the two parties tied is going to be running the country and the other isn't. But having said that, there's always another parameter, and that is the question on the table now is, will Gantz, the guy who lost, who people had a lot of faith in to win, will he nevertheless end up in the government? Unlike what we experience in America, when someone loses the election, they're out of the picture for at least some portion of time. Can you imagine if President Trump defeated Hillary Clinton and the next morning Hillary Clinton was sitting by his side as vice president or secretary of defense or something of that nature? That happens frequently here, and everybody's kind of hanging on whether or not Gantz will eat one of his promises and take that kind of position.
So Benjamin Netanyahu has essentially won, but his rival could also be in the government. Because what is the policy issue at stake here? What is the central issue where they differ?
They differ in very little. A lot of it is domestic. Benny Gantz, who is a former Army Chief of Staff, put together a party, the top four seats of which were three former Army Chiefs of Staff. Uh-huh. So for the first time, Netanyahu got neutralized on the defense issue.
I see.
So foreign policy-wise, defense-wise, it's going to be pretty much the same. There's going to be a big struggle over whether Benny Gantz, if he comes in the government, will be able to reignite the affection of some of the liberal community in the United States, particularly the Jewish community, that feels alienated under Netanyahu. And those kind of domestic issues will play. But by and large, you're not going to see huge changes.
And does this election do anything to propel some kind of Mideast peace deal or change the approach taken to the occupied territories?
That's the big question on the table. The first thing that happened based on this election was what didn't happen, and that was the so-called Trump proposal, the peace plan that he's been working on and his team headed by his son-in-law that they've been working on since they came to office. They purposely didn't put that on the table until after the elections because they didn't want to embarrass Netanyahu. Now, if they're talking in terms of not embarrassing Netanyahu, it would seem that that means right off the bat that it's going to be something that the Arabs are not going to find acceptable in their negotiating side. So what that means, nobody knows, but that's the next round, and that will be determined. Again, a lot of it's going to depend on whether it's going to be a strict demarcation where Netanyahu will head up a right-wing coalition and nothing will break into that, no accommodations, no cross-pollination, no working together. If that's the case, expect just more of the same and nothing different. If there is some kind of mix now, perhaps because Netanyahu feels he is in the latter part of his career, that's maybe a stretch though, or for whatever other reasons there is a mix available, then something could happen. But right now there's nothing as a result of this election that tells me that things are going to be significantly different.
Michael Friedson joining us from the Media Line in Jerusalem, and you can find his website at themedialine.org. It's a great source of news about Israel and the Middle East from people who actually live there. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk about how to tax rich people. It turns out not to be so easy, and in fact, it's a subject of investigation by ProPublica. Paul Keel is one of the reporters working on this story. And Paul, can I ask you about your politics? Because listeners are going to ask me. So are you motivated by some fundamental hatred of billionaires here?
No, we're motivated by taking a look at what I think you could argue is the most important agency in the federal government and how it's doing, and the answer is not well.
Mm-hmm. That being the IRS. Are you motivated by a desire to turn America into some kind of socialist country?
No. Fairness is an issue that we're kind of emphasizing in this coverage, and fairness is what you hear talk about when we speak to people who work in the IRS and ask them, you know, what motivates them, why are they doing what they're doing. And the reality is that it's a lot easier for the IRS to keep tabs on people lower down the income scale. If you're someone who gets a W-2, the IRS doesn't have to guess in terms of how much income you're taking home at the end of the day. But when you start looking at billionaires, people who have very large sort of business enterprises, that's where things get really complicated, and you do need, if you're going to have a system that's fair and people are paying a fair share up and down the income scale, you need the IRS to be a part of that.
And so that's why you've been investigating how difficult it is to get people who are billionaires to pay the tax that they owe. So you document a number of stories here, but the real nugget of it is that the IRS had or tried to set up what's called the equivalent of a SEAL Team 6 to try and get to the bottom of how rich people tend to hide their money. And I wanted to read this quote here because I thought it was very good. You write, when it comes to understanding how the super wealthy move their money around, IRS auditors historically have been more like high school physics teachers trying to operate the Large Hadron Collider. So this idea of the IRS as being a group of all-knowing accountants who can figure out anything, you make it sound like they are completely overmatched by the people that they're trying to keep honest.
Yeah, I mean, on the other side of the table, you have extremely intelligent people, you know, the tax lawyers, the accountants, people at the big four accounting firms who go to work for corporations and for the wealthy. So it's not like, you know, your typical situation where the IRS is the big boogeyman. And this, you know, if there's a David and Goliath in this situation, oftentimes the IRS is on the David side of the scale. And that has to do with just how complicated things can do when you start having people who have international businesses, who are moving money around from different legal entities, who have pass-through entities, who have LLCs and all these things. And there can be a lot of gray area. You know, it's not always, you know, cut and dried, someone was hiding income. It's that they really push the envelope in terms of, you know, a certain transaction being classified in a certain way so that it's tax advantageous, and then you need the IRS to come in on the other side of the table to argue back. And then you need smart and sophisticated people who know their stuff to do that. And right now, the IRS has been bleeding people. There's been budget cuts over the last 8 years, and they've been losing really good people. They've been losing experts, and this is one area where they've suffered a lot because of that.
How much legitimately taxable income is being hidden from the IRS? Did you come up with a number?
The one comprehensive study that we'd seen on that was looking at how much people were hiding in income and how much they should have paid in taxes. And if you just look at the top 0.5% of the income scale, the estimate was over $50 billion a year of taxes that are not paid because income is being hidden. There's just a lot of different ways to move income around. You know, normal people don't have Swiss bank accounts, to take sort of an obvious example. Yeah. Those are, you know, the more sophisticated ways that you can move stuff around to make it harder to track.
$50 billion a year. It's a lot of money, but, I mean, we're running deficits of $1 trillion a year. So you could argue it's couch change. I mean, if you were to if you had your way and the IRS did have a team capable of making sure that every really rich guy and gal paid what they owe, would you be able to cut taxes for the middle class?
I mean, you know, it's up to our Congress to do what they will. I mean, I think the concept I keep going back to is fairness. There's a lot of things the IRS should be doing that it's not. We could focus on audits of people at the very top of the income scale. There's also simply basic things like going out and collecting taxes that people didn't pay. They're not doing a lot of things that they should, and actually we're at the point now where President Trump in his last budget proposed giving a lot more money to the IRS. The budget cuts, I think, everyone now realizes this is not a good state of affairs. So hopefully this is something where the two sides can come together and agree that, you know, it makes no sense to starve the IRS of resources because it's one of the few areas of government that you actually get a lot more than you put in terms of revenue.
So there is bipartisan agreement that the IRS does need to start hiring more auditors.
Right. I mean, but, you know, Congress being what it is, that doesn't mean it's actually going to happen. But one can hope, and it's a good sign, that kind of we've reached the bottom of these budget cuts that have gone on now for about 8 years.
Isn't part of the problem also that it's very difficult sometimes to define what a transaction is? Is anybody who has actually gone beyond their tax software and looked at the IRS manual, I mean, you have to
understand a whole new language to try to figure out what even what they're aiming at in some of these rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think a general concept is that people can afford to have the best legal and tax help. Oftentimes, complexity in the tax code benefits them, and their intelligent lawyers can pay for themselves and finding ways to plan in a way that's tax advantageous when it doesn't. Complexity is not advantageous for people who are trying, like you said, to pore over, you know, IRS guidance and figure out what's what. And I should say that the new tax bill that was passed in 2017 makes everything more complicated, particularly for people higher up the income scale. There's a lot of, I guess, games that could be played because it kind of opened up new areas. It's a very complicated bill. I've heard a number of tax professionals say, golly, this thing's super complicated. And it's gonna be even harder for the IRS to stay on top of certain types of income for that reason.
So it sounds like your story at least has sparked some interest among members of Congress, and they plan to do something about it?
There has been some noises from Congress, and like I said, there is a cost to gutting the IRS. So, yeah, I think the conversation has hopefully changed, and then you can get to talking about what the IRS should look like going forward if it does start to be able to regrow, I guess, after all these years of being drained.
Yeah. Paul Keel's story is headlined, "The Top 0.5% Underpay $50 Billion a Year in Taxes and Crushed the IRS Plan to Stop Them." It's from ProPublica.org, and Paul Keel wrote it with Jesse Eisinger. Paul, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for having me.
Now for your daily dose of kindness. It takes us to Lewiston, Maine. Students came up with an easy way to try and combat bullying. They call it Lock in Your Kindness, and they spend one evening putting Post-it notes on every student's locker with a positive message written on it. The Post-its say things like, "If you are reading this, I love you." "Most obstacles melt away when we make up our minds and walk boldly through them," or "You are enough, just as you are." The students behind the project told WGME-TV, "Fighting bullying comes down to saving lives."
Hearing stories about children of any age getting bullied and getting depression because of it, not wanting to go to school, like, that's so awful.
You never know what someone's going through. One bad thing that you can say to them could trigger something else, and one thing could lead to the next, and you never know what could happen.
They wrote more than 2,000 Post-it notes. The mayor of the town even came out to help them stick them on the lockers.
Now time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.
Were you beatboxing, Dave?
I was.
It's always good to try something new on your birthday.
I know.
It's your birthday?
Yeah.
It is my birthday.
Happy birthday, Dave.
Thank you so much. Here he is by popular demand, the demon of the sports department. It is Danny O'Neill.
I think I get what you're doing.
You get what I'm doing?
Lots of D's.
Yeah.
D. Gordon.
Yeah. Here's what happened last night in Kansas City, among other things.
Junis in with a sign. Here is the 3-1 pitch. Swing and a fly ball to straightaway left field in deep. Going back. Gordon to the warning track near the wall. Leaps up. Goodbye, baseball. Jay Bruce with an opposite field home run into the Mariners' bullpen, straight away left field.
And then D. Gordon.
Swinging a ground ball right side, diving stop, D. Gordon, backhand pitch to Moore at second for one, the relay to first, not in time. Holy smokes, what a stop by D. Gordon.
That was a particularly wild play.
Because he dove with his glove.
He dove with his glove.
Grabbed it with his glove, and then backhand pitched it all with his glove. Never used his throwing hand.
That's crazy.
It was really remarkable. He had three great defensive
plays
in yesterday's game.
Why do they keep, when he's on fire, why do they keep hitting to him?
Yeah, it's a great question. You don't want to mess him. He's like a hot goalie. You know what they say when a goalie in the NHL gets really hot? The goalie stood on his head.
Stood on his head?
Which doesn't really make sense to
me. No sense at all.
Yeah, he stood on his head.
Most hockey terms don't make sense.
But that's what D. Gordon did last night. D. Gordon absolutely stood on his head, except he was diving to his right and to his left to make great plays. Also had three hits, drove in two runs, and the Mariners win again. You played the home run by Jay Bruce.
Yeah.
That is
13 straight.
Yes. They've homered in every single game. If they homer today,
yes,
and that game first pitch is at 5:10,
yeah,
they're going to match the major league record for most home runs in games to start.
See, here's,
a season.
Here's where it starts. Here's where it starts going south, because now
expectations are too high.
Yeah, but no, the records start kicking in. If they can only do this, and then if they can only do that, because to me the key to the success has been that this has been this under the radar team that wasn't supposed to do anything.
We're not supposed to talk about
it. That's right. They sneak up on you.
Keep doubting them. Then
it's possible. I thought it was the Costanza effect.
The Costanza effect.
George Costanza, in his most successful run at a job, he started doing the opposite. Right. He started doing the opposite of everything he thought. Mm. Like what he was supposed to do, he would just flip around and do the opposite. The Mariners' marketing slogan this year, their idea was, well, we're going to take a step back. and now they've taken the great leap forward. Mm-hmm. Because for years they've been like, this is our year. And then we're like, not so much. Believe big. Yeah, believe big time.
Let's put some doubt in there then. All right? Let's put some doubt in there. Not be too optimistic, which is against my nature.
You don't think they're going to homer tonight?
Our bats are hot.
Yes.
But where's our Achilles heel?
Defense. Mm-hmm. Home runs and errors. That's what the Mariners do.
Mm-hmm.
Home runs and errors. Yeah. Except for D. Gordon, because D. Gordon's great in the field.
Are they going to wear out Marco Gonzalez? Because they now, what I'm reading here is the expectation is that every time he starts, he'll pitch 6-7 innings.
He's been great so far. No, I don't think they're going to wear him out. He's a young, hale, and hearty lad who's a couple years now removed from the arm surgery.
Yeah.
They nursed him back to health. He's got a competitor's fiery temperament. He's got 4 wins. It's pretty good, huh?
Like a wounded puppy.
4 wins?
To prove something.
That's exactly right. Uh-huh.
You know what I like to see, too, is the team gelling. I love to see those shots of them in the dugout, smiling, high-fiving each other. I like that. I like the team cohesion.
Who also got on board is Cable Thanos. Huh? Are you familiar with Cable Thanos?
No. Don't talk about Thanos this close to the Avengers.
He's on the Twitter. He's on the Twitter.
Yeah.
And Cable Thanos became relatively well-known for the Seahawk hype videos that he put together.
Uh-huh.
And he did one for the Mariners yesterday.
And
if you look it up, he's a student at Western Washington, and he gained attention. He had a Twitter interaction with Russell Wilson. They were going to play Super Smash Brothers together because that was Cable Thanos' dream. Go ahead and take a look at it because it's pretty fantastic.
What a name, though.
I know. Well, it's because they thought Tom Cable, the old offensive line coach, kind of looked like Thanos from the Avengers.
Oh.
So it's Cable Thanos.
So it's Cable.
So that's not his real name.
No, I think his real name is Josh.
It must be this 2-minute, 20-second video. The Mariners are back.
Yeah, with a little bit of
excited.
With a little bit of McConaughey.
I see
mixed
that.
In
yeah.
there.
Okay, good. I'll take a look. I'll watch.
In other news, what's the deal with Cuba that the Trump administration is canceling? Explain that to me.
Well, so for years there's been essentially a black market of players leaving Cuba to get to the U.S. There was no other way for them to get to the U.S. other than escape to a third country, and then from there request asylum. And that has to do with the national policy on Cuban defectors, that you could not show up in the U.S. directly from Cuba. You had to be somewhere else. For baseball players, what this meant is when you had a very prominent player who was going to be a millionaire once he gets to the major leagues, once he's able to sign with major league teams, it put them in situations where when they left the country, they would be in this no man's land, under the quote-unquote protection or being trafficked, essentially, by gangsters. You had stories of guys eating a Haitian passport. Jose Abreu had to do that, a big-time slugger. The Mariners had Leonis Martin, who was held in a hotel for several days by men with guns. Now, he said that it wasn't like they were trained on him. But he couldn't leave. He wasn't free to leave. And the difficulty that you get, and those guys will ask for a portion of your earnings, as much as 25%.
Right.
Baseball came up with a policy that allowed Cubans to leave their teams. They weren't prevented from leaving Cuba, which was part of the problem, is they had to sneak out. In exchange, the major league teams would pay their Cuban teams for the players they were leaving. The player would still have to go to a third country.
Mm-hmm.
They would still have to go there. But because they weren't having to leave in the dark of night.
So they legitimized this process.
Yes. It was still a little convoluted because our country is still goofy when it comes to our relationship with Cuba. But it was more straightforward. The Trump administration has scuttled that. And everybody knew there was a chance that would happen. But they have officially.
So they have to go underground again if they want to do this?
There is no above board
because
they're not allowing an actual economic relationship to take place between the U.S. major leagues and the Cuban clubs that would be, quote unquote, posting the players.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
How about that for some immigration policy?
Yeah.
You didn't expect that coming from me.
I did not. I am impressed.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Seattle Times columnist Briar Dudley, his latest piece is kind of a back to the future thing in which he makes the argument for Seattle to bring back the ride-free zone. Remember the ride-free zone? Used to call it the magic carpet, just making bus rides free through the downtown core.
Well, up until 2012, for about 40 years, downtown Seattle had free buses. Basically, you just hop on, hop off anytime. And it was really great for going places like, say, at lunch. If you wanted to go from one end of town to the other, you just hop on, and it made it very easy. But they had some budget challenges, and there was some pushback against it. And suburban people, the legislators were kind of upset about it. And so they killed it in 2012. And it didn't cost very much. It was only about $2 million a year. In fare loss, and it carried about 30,000 people. So bring us forward to 2019, and we're about to drop $300 million or so, extending the streetcar. And once it's all done, for $300 million, we're going to be able to carry maybe 22,000 people, if you believe the city's optimistic forecasts. So for a lot less money, we could have a lot better and a lot more flexible system of getting around downtown if we just went back to ride-free.
And you would drop the trolley extension then, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing has failed to get any of the ridership that was forecasted. The budgets, the budget forecasting has been dismal. It's twice as much as they expected it would be. So we're paying through the nose for something that few people ride. I don't know if you all have experienced that, but if you're downtown or at South Lake Union or in Chinatown International District sometime, just take a look. It's right in front of us. Very, very few people are on that thing. You know, my commuting, I take the bus or I walk, and so I look every day, I have for years at this thing, and I take pictures all the time, too, just to keep track of it, because people don't believe me. They're like, oh, no, it's popular here, it's popular there. I was like, well, I have a phone full of pictures of empty streetcars just sitting there. So, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that it's been a boondoggle, and we got to do something else.
Now, the supporters of this, of course, Dudley, would say, well, just like they do with the bike master plan is, well, we got to build it all the way out, or else no one will use it until it goes from Capitol Hill all the way around to join to South Lake Union and go someplace. Do you buy that argument?
I don't buy it for a couple of reasons. One, if you look around the country, other streetcars haven't done that well either. I mean, this isn't just a Seattle phenomenon. Lots of cities have put these things in as economic development, kind of commercial real estate amenities, and they never really do pan out the way you think they would. Another thing is we're spending a fortune already extending light rail and increasing the frequency of buses right along the path that the streetcar is going. If you look around the rest of the city, we can't afford to keep our libraries open. We can't afford to maintain our parks. So they keep coming back and asking for levy increases to fund these things. Meanwhile, we're throwing $300 million at a streetcar that hardly anybody rides.
My big concern about this going forward, in addition to the money, is what it's going to do to First Ave. And you brought that up in your piece as well. We're going to reduce it by half at the same time when we're going with a new toll starting on, later this year on 99. Where, you said limited capacity, does it make any sense to get rid of two lanes of traffic on a main north-south through the city of Seattle?
There's this fantasy that people have at City Hall that cars are just going to magically go away if they do these things. And it's funny because they say that, but then when they're doing a project like the Key Arena remodel for hockey, they had to do a very scientific study of how much traffic is going to go to the hockey games. And the study says, we're going to have a lot more cars here, and it's going to suck. Why don't they apply that kind of logic and decision-making to downtown when they have a project like this? So you're absolutely right. It's going to take two lanes out of First Avenue. It's going to make the remaining lanes much less functional.
But there's one more thing we're not talking about when it comes to the ride-free zone. I'm old enough to remember when it was there, and one of the reasons it was ended was because it became basically a residence for homeless people who would just stay on the buses and ride around and around and around. And after a while, they decided if this is going to remain viable, we just have to start charging fares so they don't use it as much.
Well, has that changed? I mean, I don't want to bash anybody, any population or anything like that, but if you're a regular bus rider, you've experienced that kind of thing, and it hasn't really changed. It is what it is, and, we just had a story the other day talking about the high frequency of people that aren't paying fares. More than half of them identify as homeless. So, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's a bit of an issue, but it's been an issue before, it's an issue now. I think that's moot, really. Another thing Metro is doing is talking about ways to provide more fares to people who don't have any money, which, great. But the population you're talking about is going to be on the bus one way or the other.
Briar Dudley from the Seattle Times. New DUI laws, crackdowns on carpool violators, and what to do about cars that veer into bike lanes. The legislature is considering all this stuff, and here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Hello, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. So first, let's talk DUIs and going after those repeat offenders. Right now, state law makes, as we know, fourth DUI in 10 years a felony, which means prison time. But oftentimes, especially in deadly DUI crashes, we see drunk drivers with four, five, six, as high as 11 previous DUIs. Why are they still behind the wheel? There are several reasons, including the fact that their DUIs are often spread out over many years outside that 10-year window to fall into that felony category where they get that prison time. A proposal from Senator Mike Patton early in the session would have extended that look-back period to 15 years, but it died in committee. But now it has been resurrected and is moving forward as part of another very comprehensive DUI bill. Russell Brown with the Washington Association of Prosecutors is thrilled to see that Patton proposal back in play.
The 15-year look back, we think, is a significant enhancement to our current DUI laws. The day after that bill died, I received an email from Skagit County Prosecutor Rich Weirich, who just that day after received a referral for a DUI. Individual had seven prior DUIs. But because of the timing of those, it was outside of the felony provision. But with the 15-year look back, it would be within that. Every time someone drives under the influence, it puts the rest of us at risk.
The 15-year look-back provision was added to a bill from Democratic Representative Roger Goodman that makes several other changes to our DUI laws, including increasing the amount of time that a person has to use an ignition interlock device, stronger penalties for drunk drivers who have kids in the car when they're arrested, and a lot more, including a change that gives an impaired driver a chance to change their mind if they get behind the wheel intoxicated.
You're stupid enough to get on the road impaired, but then smart enough to realize you shouldn't be driving. Get off the road, get out of the driver's seat, and turn the car off. It's that simple. Get out of the driver's seat and turn the car off, and you probably won't even be arrested. And if you are, you will not be prosecuted and convicted.
So this is what's considered being safely off the roadway. And if you talk to Representative Goodman, he'll say this is one of the big highlights of this bill, because right now there's no definition for that.
But so you mean now if you did that, you'd get arrested?
It's possible that you'd get arrested. Absolutely. And what I think what he's trying to get here, even in this hearing yesterday, he made a really big point of saying, anyone who's listening, I want you to be aware of this, that we're trying to make this change, because it's another stopgap to try to see if you do have these people who get behind the wheel, maybe they remember that this is the law and they go, you know what? I don't have to keep trying to go. I can pull off. This is what I have to do. And maybe that saves a life. So this is actually this very comprehensive bill that he's doing is something he's been working on for years. And we got that 15-year look back added to it. So it is passing, awaiting one more floor vote and doing very well. So we could get that 15-year look
back. On the ignition interlocks, what are the criteria for those now? I mean, when do you get one installed?
If you have a DUI, you get one installed.
So the first DUI.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have one installed.
Do
they not work then? I mean, if you get it after the first DUI, then how come people are getting four, five, and six?
There are different reasons. You know, for instance, on I-5, that repeat DUI offender last summer who hit the woman and killed the woman from Oregon after driving down I-5 in Arlington for 6 miles the wrong way, he was supposed to have an ignition interlock device. He didn't have one because he took his daughter's vehicle. So, they've made a bunch of other changes, though. It's very interesting. There are people who will get someone else to blow in it for them. So now what they've done is they've changed the law.
Did the daughter know? Do we know if she knew or not?
I know. I haven't followed up. I know at the time there was this discussion about possible charges against her for allowing.
Well, I'm not saying let's lock everybody up, but I mean, that is something that I hadn't thought about. That's something to keep in mind, though. So if you have any family member who's had a DUI bad enough to require an interlock device, then it's on you to make sure they don't take your
car. Yeah, absolutely. That's a big deal. And then they've, again, also made some big changes. So if you're going to blow in someone else's ignition interlock device, now they've got cameras in there so that they can catch you. They also have GPS devices that help them track and make sure that people aren't lying about those. So this will be a big deal. And again, extends the time that you need that ignition interlock device which Representative Goodman is excited about. Remember the bill to dramatically increase the fines for carpool lane cheaters?
Yes.
So this one is also staying alive, moving ahead. This is the proposal that hits single drivers in the carpool lane with increasing penalties for multiple offenses now within 2-year period. Right now, it's $136 a ticket for a carpool violation, and that's what it is always, no matter how many times you do it. The initial ticket under this would jump to $186. That's up $50. And then your second one would go to $336, and your third violation goes to $686.
Whoa.
Right. It's big. And it's actually the way that this bill is right now, it's about $100 less than the original proposal, which would have had that third offense at $755. But this is still too high for several lawmakers in the House.
When we start talking about traffic infractions getting up into the $686 range, that's a lot. When I think of somebody making $15 an hour and a week's worth of pay for an infraction like that, gives me some concerns.
You know, it is frustrating to see people driving in that HOV lane, but I think it's quite a jump to go to $686. And there are a lot of horrible violations out there, and I don't think that they are increased like that. I would like to see us focus more on, you know, things like violations in school zones.
And that last speaker is Representative John Lovick, and he said he didn't have a problem with the up to 186 for the first one, 336 for the second, but that big 686 at the end is kind of a concern. So it sounds like it's already passed the Senate, and they'll have to work out some differences in the House. There might be an effort to try to lower that third one. But the best part of this bill is that this is the one that if you've got the fake person in your passenger
yes.
seat, $200 fine extra on top all right. of all of this. So no fake
yeah.
dummies, no hey, balloons with masks.
Did they take up my idea for the platinum drive anywhere pass where, you know, because for the people who abuse this, according to Chris anyway, this is a cost of doing business. If they got to pay
right.
$200, $300, $400, they don't care because they're making tech money.
They budget that. I think we have someone who's a talk show host here who does that.
Really?
John Curley does that.
That would shock me. Really? Is that yeah. the name? Okay. So I'm thinking, though, for people, since the state is always needing money to do whatever, why not monetize that and say, let's say, I don't know, for $100,000 a year, you get the platinum pass and you can drive always and anywhere in any lane you want with impunity. And you get a little gold sticker, you know, for your license plate. And we reward you for forking over your money.
Yeah. But I've not heard that brought up. It sounds like a good idea to me. Although, you know, the $686 for those three-time offenders, that could add up, too. So we'll see. But anyways, both of these still alive. Real quickly, I'll just mention there's another bill that actually passed the House yesterday. It's a very wide-ranging bill that creates some new rules for if you're passing someone, not in a bike lane, but if they're driving on in the right lane with you. It talks about how close you can follow the right way to get out of the way. Really, to help the goal here is to protect both pedestrians and bicyclists.
Right.
And it increases the penalty.
What is the rule on that? I know you can't stray into the bike lane, but for example, on a lane when it's a shared lane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the bicycle's going, you know, 8 miles an hour, and you want to go 40. What's the safe passing?
Reduce speed to a safe speed. Doesn't say what, and then relative for the area that you're in, and pass at a safe distance. Practical of about 3 feet.
3 feet.
3 feet.
Okay.
There you go. And if you don't, if you violate, there's a lot of rules in this. They're basically increasing the fine for violating this by $48. So that'll go up to $186.
Okay. Typically, I just don't pass. But the guys behind me always get annoyed when I do that.
Right. It's tough. Like even here, if I go up to get on I-5, there's right. bicyclists. There's just the one lane you can be in, and they're in front of me. And I'm never quite sure what I'm. It's just one lane. Am I just going to wait? They don't go as fast as the cars.
I just take deep breaths. And I say, okay, I'm going to crawl along with the cyclist. But it's the guy behind me who thinks I'm
impatient.
An idiot.
Impatient. Yeah, absolutely. But
that
it's so
you,
scary.
Is it?
It's not me. I try to be very patient.
Okay. Thank you.